Anti-Semitic incidents are on the increase in Australia. The Executive Council of Australian Jewry's latest report on anti-Semitism records 331 incidents in 2020, well above the average for previous years of 272. It's particularly worrying that from 2019 to 2020, the number of reported incidents of physical assault doubled, along with increases in direct verbal abuse, harassment and intimidation, and threats by post and phone. Socialists are fierce opponents of all forms of racism, whether against Indigenous people, migrants, Muslims or Jews. So on the face of it, it should be good news that Prime Minister Scott Morrison declared on the 13th of October that anti-Semitism has no place in Australia. It has no place anywhere in the world. But he was doing so as he announced that Australia would, quote, embrace the definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, unquote. And that's the IHRA. Far from helping the fight against anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition has been weaponized, first and foremost, to outlaw serious criticism of Israel and to smear those who, like us here in solidarity, support the Palestinian struggle for national liberation. To help make sense of the issues, I'm talking today with Rob Ferguson. Rob is an anti-racist activist and a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, Solidarity's sister organisation in Britain. He's written widely on the use of the IHRA definition in Britain to muzzle the left and hold back the Palestine Solidarity movement. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. Rob, welcome.
Thanks, Dave.
Look, first up, the Holocaust is a very real part of your family history. Can you tell us about your background?
My mother was born in Budapest, and she left Hungary in the mid-1930s and came to Britain and thus escaped the Holocaust. Members of my mother's family did not, including her sister, my aunt, Agnes. And the genocide of Hungarian Jewry represented the peak of the Nazi Holocaust in Europe. Over 10 weeks in 1944, from May through to July, 475,000 Hungarian Jews were rounded up and transported direct to the gas chambers of Auschwitz. They extended the railway lines so that they got off the trains and straight into the gas chambers. It was the horrific peak of the Holocaust, and when the deportations ended, the horror didn't end. The Hungarian Nazis, the Arrow Cross, launched their own slaughter of Hungarian Jews in Budapest, which is when my aunt was killed, along with thousands of others by the side of the Danube. My father was born in Glasgow. His parents came from what was called the Pale of Russia, now the territory occupied by Ukraine, Lithuania, Poland. Both my parents were Communist Party members before the war. They raised support for the international brigades. My father was at the big mobilization against the British fascist Oswald Mosley at the Olympia Stadium in West London. They both went to Palestine in the 1930s, and my father went with his family, but he left disillusioned. He went as a socialist Zionist. He joined the Haganah, the Zionist militia, but his socialist beliefs and his Zionism came into conflict, and he made a choice. And he chose to keep his socialist principles. He left Palestine and came back to Britain and became active in the Communist Party. So I guess I've I'm not saying my politics are exactly the same as my parents on every count, but I inherited a huge amount, and not least some fundamental principles. They went on, the lessons they drew, I think, from the Nazi period was an uncompromising solidarity with the victims of racism, wherever they might be. So they supported the civil rights movement in the United States. They went on the anti-apartheid marches, and they every year marched with CND. So, and they took me on those demonstrations as a young child. So I owe them a huge debt for that. And I think above all, that sense of always siding with the victim, regardless of what your own background, nationality, race, religion might be, or theirs, that I think that principle has stayed with me and I've tried to keep to it.
A good principle to have. Now, here in Australia, Nazi groups are still small, but they have been growing in confidence. How would you characterise the global threat from the far right?
I think it's important to understand the conditions in which the far right have risen, Dave, because these conditions are universal. They affect every part of the globe. We have seen a gathering crisis of the economic system across the world. And that's reflected in a political crisis, a crisis of what I would call the neoliberal centre, what the socialist Tariq Ali has called the extreme centre, a crisis that is reflected across Europe, North America, and elsewhere, in which both the social democratic centre and the conservative centre, if you like, have seen a massive decline of their base and their voting support. Of course, this is against the background of the financial crisis of 2008, and most recently now, the impact of the pandemic economically and politically. But of course, that too takes place against the background of decades of austerity and neoliberalism and a huge opening of the gap between the 1% at the top of the society and the rest of us. And this has led to a polarization, political polarization. We've seen the rise of radical left movements and parties such as Syriza, and of course in Britain, most recently, Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Left Project. But we've also seen the rise of the right, from Trump in the US to Orban, and of course, far right street movements and fascist movements and so forth. I think one has to acknowledge, unfortunately, that at the moment, the right have had the advantage. They've made the most gains. The recent elections for governor in Virginia, I think, are a warning of what can happen as the neoliberal center collapses, with the victory of the right-wing Republican just, a year or so into Biden's term. When we look at the far right, we have to, there are broadly speaking, four movements, really, four different types. You have the hardcore neo-Nazis, which I know have begun to raise their head in Australia, but of course elsewhere. You then have what are often termed in Europe the Euro-fascists. They tend to avoid mobilizations on the streets. They convey an image of electoral respectability. Nonetheless, it's not an electoral project. They are using an election platform to build a wider base in society from which they can then build fascist organization. You then have what are often termed the right-wing populists or the far-right populists, people like Trump, of course, or Viktor Orban in Hungary. And finally, you have the street movements. In Britain, we had the English Defence League mobilizing at their height tens of thousands against the threat of Islamic extremism, supposedly, you know, Islamophobic movements. Scoping that picture out, it's also important to say that this is quite a challenge for the left, because these are not rigidly defined sections of the right. They're permeable. You know, their supporters and their leaders can not only just move from one position to another, but crucially, their support base can move between these different groups. And crucially, the right-wing populists commanding positions of government, in many cases, lay the ground for the other forces on the right. So a victory for Trump, a victory for Orban, is a victory for the right in which all their boats can rise. That's the real danger of the threat. And we should remember that the rise of fascist organization, fascist parties, and the Nazi party in Europe in the 1930s, you know, rose on the back of authoritarian governments and regimes that laid, you know, the kind of ideological climate in which the Nazis could build. And we should remember that for today. Crucially, the main driver for the rise of the far right, on which they have built, has been the tide of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim hate. It's not the only one, but it has been absolutely critical. Here again, they have built on the institutionalized Islamophobia and measures taken by all our governments under the banner of the war of terror. And of course, we are now seeing, in addition to all these reactionary narratives against Muslims and so on, the development of the so-called culture wars and so forth. I mean, if I could just finish on the answer to this question. You see, I think France is a very important example for us here, because we have seen there the rise of Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, and what is now called National Rally, beforehand the Front National, whose project, Marine Le Pen's project, was to so-called detoxify the Front National. She represented what I referred to before, the attempt to establish a respectable electoral platform for fascist organization. Her difficulty has been, in a sense, she's been a victim of their success. They've pulled the whole of the mainstream to the right. And I mean, not only the conservative center, but the Socialist Party, the left center, the Social Democrat, into Islamophobia, anti-migrant narratives, defending the French nation, and so on and so forth. So the line between Le Pen and the center starts to become blurred. And we've now seen the emergence of Eric Zemmour, in many ways to the right of Le Pen, but reconstituting different forces on the right, and much openly espousing the most foul reactionary narratives, touching on fascist and neo-Nazi positions, the idea of the great replacement of the French nation being undermined by globalists bringing in Muslim migrants and so forth. What is crucial here is how this ground has been laid. And there we have to lay the responsibility again at the door of the centre, not least Macron, you know, who has led a charge in defence of Republican France against Muslims over the question of the veil, banning Muslims' organisations that monitor hate crimes and so forth. So I think we have to look at the lessons of France, of the United States, and elsewhere in order to lay the basis of an opposition to this threat. We shouldn't think that anywhere in the world is immune. Different states, different countries may be on different trajectories, but the conditions of crisis, the polarization of politics, the attempts by forces on the far right, whether they be the right-wing populists or the fascists, are seeking to take advantage. And we can see it in the culture wars, in the attack on migrants, in the attack on Muslim communities, and so forth.
And of course, things like the so-called Great Replacement Theory and the term globalist are all opening the door to overt anti-Semitism. They're code terms for theories which encourage anti-Semitism, which brings us back to the IHRA's working definition of anti-Semitism. Now, it was only adopted in May 2016, but it's rapidly becoming the establishment's common sense view. So why does the ruling class in Britain and now Australia and elsewhere find it so useful?
I think it's quite important to just step back and look at IHRA. In the IHRA, as you say, Dave, was adopted in May 2016. But the context is important because it takes place against the background of an ideological offensive that really took off in the early 2000s, a decade and a half before. An ideological offensive under the banner of what was called the new anti-Semitism. Now, the origins of the new anti-Semitism, the narrative of the new anti-Semitism, lie in the 1960s, in the wake of the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. And its fundamental premise is that a new threat to Jews has now emerged, equivalent to, if not greater than, the threat from the right. From the left, the anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist left, and now from Muslim communities. In the 1960s, the narrative was directed at the anti-imperialist wing of the anti-Vietnam War movement and the New Left, and the Black Power movement, the anti-colonial Black Power movement. Today, again, against the left, but crucially against Muslim communities. And indeed, from the early 2000s on, the main target, sometimes this has been a bit, this is lost because of the central importance of the attacks on Corbyn and the Left Project in the UK. The main target across Europe and North America were Muslims. The left was seen as useful idiots or the allies of the Islamists in what was called often the Red-Green Alliance. The context of the eruption of this offensive in the early 2000s is, of course, 9/11, the war on terror, the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. At the same time, we have the Second Intifada, the collapse of the facade of the Oslo Accords, the election victory of Hamas in 2006, and not least, the Arab revolutions of 2011. So simultaneously, our rulers faced a crisis of imperialism in the Middle East. And at the same time, the war on terror came home in the attacks on what was termed Muslim extremism, Islamism, perception that Muslim communities, who of course overwhelmingly opposed the military interventions in the Middle East and the war on terror at home, were hostile and a suspect population. I think it's important to understand the adoption of the IHRA in that context. If you look at the conferences, the meetings, the vast number of articles and journals published by those who were the drivers of the IHRA definition, then these themes of the threat from Muslim migrant populations in European cities, of the anti-war movement, of the left, and so on, run through the articles, the conferences, and the meetings time and time again. And that's really the context of the IHRA definition in the broader sense. But there is, of course, a very specific sense, very specific conditions in which it emerged, not least the assault on Gaza in 2014, 2 years before the definition. The attack on Gaza brought to the eyes of the world the real nature of the Israeli regime, to a far wider audience than had been previously the case. It posed huge difficulties for the pro-Zionist camp, and not just the, if you like, the tribunes of the State of Israel, but more widely in the context of the crisis in the Middle East for the major imperialist powers themselves, for our own governments, for our own states. This was a problem. I would argue that it's true to say, in a sense, that the crisis of the Middle East, in the Middle East, has made Fortress Israel more important to the major imperialist powers, arguably, than at any time. They cannot rely on the stability of the Arab regimes. If you look at 2011, the Arab revolutions, however loyal particular rulers may be to the United States, Britain, and so on in the Middle East, they are subject to threat from below. A settler colonial state has a unique feature. It is not subject to overthrow by its own settler population. And in the case of Israel, unlike South Africa, the Palestinian struggle is incredibly important to the struggle against imperialism and essential in terms of the fight for the cause of Palestinian freedom. But on their own, they don't have the forces to overcome the might of the Israeli state, and they don't have sufficient economic leverage to do so. So Israel is absolutely vital to the major powers. And of course, the ideological character of the new anti-Semitism also serves a very important purpose: to delegitimize politically the left, to turn the label of racism back on the anti-racists themselves. So we see this combination, if you like, of factors coming together in the adoption of the IHRA definition in 2016 and its weaponization since.
Before we move on, perhaps you should just remind listeners what exactly the IHRA says about anti-Semitism and specifically in the context of Israel. Perhaps we're taking that for granted and we should spell that out.
Let me just quote, I think, a couple of key elements of the IHRA verbatim. There are two parts to what's called, as a whole, the IHRA definition. One is the definition itself, which is only three lines or so. Because it's short, let me just read it out. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. Now, this is, as many authorities have pointed out, including Zionist historians, Zionist authorities and others, this is a mess. What does this mean? A certain perception of Jews may be expressed as hatred. Well, may it not then? What else is it expressed as? I mean, quite a lot has been written on these three lines themselves. I think in some, it's vague. It's not actually a definition. And it has a certain bizarre quality. You then move on to the 11 examples, seven of which refer to Israel. Now, a couple of them are, you know, uncontroversial, calling for aiding or justifying the killing or harming of Jews, for example. But the key examples, and these are the examples that are used whenever the IHRA is invoked. To my knowledge, it's never been invoked against the right wing. It's never been invoked against examples of right-wing anti-Semitism. Indeed, many of its signatories, or a good number of its signatories, are governments who are notorious for their anti-Semitic politics, Hungary being one. So let's just turn to a couple of the key examples. Denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination by claiming that the existence of a state of Israel is a racist endeavor. Second, applying double standards by requiring of Israel a behaviour not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. There are other examples that reinforce that theme, but those two are absolutely critical. First of all, the question of denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination clearly aims out of court a whole corpus, a body of historical work, scholarly work, and of course, the very narrative of Palestinian freedom that sees that defines Israel's character as a settler colonial state, and therefore as whatever the intentions of many of those, like my father, who went to Palestine in the 1930s, whatever their intentions, it was inevitably a settler colonial project, therefore a racist endeavor. And the other is the question of double standards, which of course makes a presumption. Applying double standards by requiring of Israel a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. Well, first it assumes that Israel is a democratic nation, but of course there's also a wider question, isn't there? One of the accusations that is continually leveled whenever criticism is made of the state of Israel or support for the Palestinian cause, the right of return, one state solution and so forth is raised, is why are you singling out Israel? What about all the other states that oppress populations in different ways? This really is a sleight of hand. That argument in itself echoes precisely the responses made by those who defended apartheid in South Africa. What about all the black dictatorships across our borders? Why don't you attack them? We're a bastion of defense against the threat of communism and the free world. We defend your ability to have democracy, etc., etc. And of course, the other side of it is that the left and the anti-colonial movement as a whole has always, you know, what stands out about the tradition is focusing on those struggles, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist struggles, that act as, if you like, the litmus, as the focus for the wider struggle against oppression, for national freedom, and so on. And you can really run through the list. Algiers under France, Vietnam, Indonesia, South Africa. I mean, there is a very long list, and this is part of the anti-colonial tradition. Chile would be another. You focus on the struggles against oppression for freedom that in a sense pose, that not only demand solidarity in themselves, but focus our opposition against our own rulers and against the wider system of national oppression and subjugation on which imperialism depends.
Let's move on to solidarity, because you're involved in the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Britain. Now, it seems you mentioned the huge political impact of the war on Gaza in 2014. It can seem that supporters of Israel are increasingly losing the argument, which may, of course, explain why the supporters of the IHRA definition becoming increasingly shrill. Is that how you see it? Do you think actually the argument for Palestine is really beginning to make significant ground?
Short answer, yes. The revolt across the entirety of historic Palestine last May evoked an international response, demonstrations and protests in solidarity with Palestine on a global scale. In Britain, in the space of less than a week, we had two massive demonstrations in London of up to the second demonstration of 160,000, the biggest demonstration since 2014. There were demonstrations all across the country. And it wasn't just organized demonstrations. School students in large numbers spontaneously engaged in spontaneous protests, expressions of solidarity with Palestine, painting Palestine flags on their hands or on their faces, on their school bags and so forth. The response by the government and some schools to suppress those expressions of solidarity and intimidate students then resulted in a counter-response involving local communities, parents and so on. Where I live in East London, I was invited to speak within the space of a week at two local protests initiated by the local associations of mosques. Hundreds of parents, school students, community activists and so on. You could sense that the pro-Zionist camp was on the defensive. There's nothing like the self-organized activity and mobilization of the oppressed to cut through the kind of deluge of propaganda and demonization that pervades the media and, you know, political discourse. There's other very important indicators. What has sometimes some have called the unity intifada. You know, this was not just solidarity with those in Gaza under siege, as in 2014, or the struggles of the first and second intifada, primarily focused on the occupied territories. This was in every part of historic Palestine, most importantly in what is called 1948 Israel, amongst the Palestinians who formerly hold Israeli citizenship. And this tore aside the veil. It brought apartheid, the apartheid character of Israel, into plain sight. And of course, this was against the backdrop of the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem bringing out a report in January that labeled Israel as an apartheid regime from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. And this was followed by another report by Human Rights Watch, also pinning the label of apartheid. If you look at the resolutions that were then passed in the wake of those reports and the May Vault amongst trade unions in Britain, these were the toughest resolutions that we've seen. Pinning the label of apartheid on Israel and support for boycott, divestment and sanctions. And those resolutions were reflected in the resolution adopted by the Trades Union Congress a few months ago. You know, I remember when I was at university, my contemporaries would go to Israel in the summer to work on the kibbutz. I mean, this is long gone. This is, to be honest, if it wasn't for the pandemic and so forth, students would be much more likely to go to Palestine on a solidarity visit. So there has been a massive shift. And this is important in understanding the drive behind the IHRA definition. They have huge difficulty when it comes to winning the argument at the base. And therefore, they have to impose restrictions on free expression and solidarity in Palestine from the top down, through institutions of state, through public institutions, through the administrators of our universities, and through public authorities, and so on. And that's really important for the movement to understand.
And support for Palestine here in Australia was also significant back in May. I know here in Melbourne, there were multiple rallies. I think the largest was at least 10,000. And there were rallies in Sydney and elsewhere.
For 4 or 5 years, we have seen in Britain a massive offensive against the late Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour left over the question of anti-Semitism. Charges of anti-Semitism that are based on the conflation between, a false conflation between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and criticism of the state of Israel. And we've seen retreat and retreat, concession after concession, unfortunately. And the Labour Party adopted the IHRA definition itself in 2018. Yet in the space of 1 week, two demonstrations and all the spontaneous protests across Britain, we rolled back more in that 1 week than 5 years of internal battles within the Labour Party. And I think there's an important lesson as to where the strength of the left really lies.
Look, many of us here in Australia watched the destruction of Jeremy Corbyn with absolute horror. We know that he's a lifelong anti-racist, and the accusations thrown up against him were more than nonsense. They were vindictive and destructive. So how has the left responded more broadly to the double challenge of fighting anti-Semitism, particularly from the right, and standing up for Palestine, especially since the introduction of the IHRA definition? Because obviously there may well be lessons for us here in Australia.
The truth is that there have been different responses, and I think we can learn from them. The first I've already referred to. This was the response of the Corbyn leadership team, but also of a significant section of the Labour left and the wider left more generally. This was premised on the perception that if acknowledgement was made that anti-Semitism was a problem and assurances given that instances of anti-Semitism would be dealt with, that this would somehow fend off the attacks. So there was a whole process of concession and retreat. Of course, it was denied that anti-Semitism was endemic in Labour, and assurances were given that anti-Semitism would be dealt with. What was never done was to confront the attacks politically. Crucially, to insist that the conflation between anti-Zionism, criticism of the state of Israel, and anti-Semitism was false, was a fake conflation. This was never taken on. The political argument was ducked. And along the way, time and again, individuals were sacrificed. The first and most prominent was that of Ken Livingstone, former mayor of London, lifelong anti-racist, very prominent in organising and supporting anti-racist initiatives while he was mayor of London against the fascists and so forth. He was sacrificed. And then came a number of others. Now, of course, the nature of a witch hunt is that it focuses on individuals, but it is, in doing so, an attack on the entire movement. If you allow an individual to be sacrificed, then you're allowing the movement as a whole to be forced back. So that was the first response, the one of concession. There were obviously principled defences of the left. Some of these, though, tended to put almost all their focus on the internal battle within the Labour Party. Now, I'll just say this, I don't have time to kind of expand on the argument. I just would say this about the problem that they faced, was that, in a sense, they did put the argument very strongly. They did put the argument that there was no equivalence between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. They did try to expose politically the character of the assault on the Labour left. The problem was that by concentrating their focus within the structures of the Labour Party, they found that the arguments themselves didn't count. The arguments were not in that sense, within the confines of the Labour Party, the arguments were not the issue. The issue was who had the political weight. And there, the Labour right, the Parliamentary Labour Party, and the Labour Party machine was absolutely dominant. And despite a mass membership that had poured into Labour behind the Corbyn wave, the Labour left found that there was no means within the Labour Party of instrumentalising that mass base against the right wing. There was also, your question is really about how do we face the double challenge of fighting anti-Semitism and standing up for Palestine. There was also a response from some in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, which is absolutely understandable, to argue, look, don't get sucked into an argument about anti-Semitism, just talk about Palestine. Just talk about the cause of Palestinian freedom, the injustices suffered by Palestinians at the hand of the Israeli state, and the oppression of the and dispossession of the Palestinian people. Now, there's a really strong point about this argument, which was that often the focus on the Labour Party had led to an absence of the Palestinian voice. So it all became about Labour. It all became about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And the Palestinian voice had somehow evaporated. There was a very important point to this argument. I was involved in helping to organise a number of broad meetings in opposition to the IHRA. Well, the biggest of which, we filled the big Conway Hall in London and people couldn't get in. The broad platform, including from Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Stop the War Coalition, Labour Lefts and others. But on all those meetings, two things. We always had Palestine in the title, Justice for Palestine, you know, Defend the Left, Stop the IHRA, or some kind of combination of that. And we always had a Palestinian speaker. I think actually in all the meetings, we had two Palestinian speakers. That combination is very important. On all those platforms, though, I think all the speakers were always very clear about anti-Semitism as a threat to the movement, and why opposition to anti-Semitism was so important for the movement. I really think that actually you've got a model very close to home in terms of how to approach this. The letter from Palestinian students opposing the IHRA, in Australian Palestinian students, which I read recently in The Guardian, I think is a real model of how to approach this. It firmly located anti-Semitism as demanding opposition in and of itself, but it also located the threat of anti-Semitism as part of the wider threat of racism and oppression in society as a whole, and why the struggle for Palestine was part of a wider struggle that included opposition to anti-Semitism and all forms of racism. I think it's a very concise and very strong statement that I think deserves wide circulation in the Australian movement. And finally, Dave, before we go on to the more strategic questions of how to oppose the IHRA, you know, the key battleground has become in many ways the universities and the campuses, where the questions of free expression on Israel and Zionism, Palestine solidarity, and the question of opposing anti-Semitism, if you like, come together.
And that's very much where I was looking to sort of bring this conversation towards a conclusion. It's worth quoting the president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, a woman called Gillian Seagull, who welcomed Scott Morrison's announcement, which I mentioned back at the beginning of the podcast. And she said, "The IHRA definition will need to be adopted by the public and private sectors, the university sector, civil society, school education systems, and sporting organisations, among others." And I think it's very likely that, as you say, one of the first battlegrounds is likely to be amongst university activists. There are moves to support BDS, for instance, amongst union members at the University of Sydney and elsewhere. So what's your advice to activists here in Australia who are going to be confronted with these arguments quite soon, maybe in coming months and certainly over the next year or so?
The crucial lesson is that we need to lay the basis for building a broad movement. And in this context, a broad movement on the campuses within the universities on two fronts. First of all, the question of free expression on Israel and Palestine. It's quite interesting in Britain that actually the demand that the IHRA definition be by government, be adopted by universities, was not altogether popular amongst university administrations. Obviously, it has wider implications in terms of free expression, free academic expression in general, and government intervention and interference in university autonomy, academic autonomy, and so forth. This highlights a very important focus for the movement, which is the question of defending free expression. Not free expression in the abstract liberal sense of anything goes, but free expression against attempts by the state to limit the freedom of protest, the freedom of expression by the oppressed and by the left, and so forth. And this, of course, has a huge wide resonance, both amongst academics and students, beyond the question of Israel and Palestine. And so it means that in opposing the IHRA definition, first of all, the premises for winning the widest base of support should not be made conditional on whether you're anti-Zionist or whether you support a particular view on Israel, Palestine, and the solution. What it does have to do is insist on certain principles. First of all, that whatever your view on Israel, Zionism, Palestine, it is not anti-Semitic to advance an anti-Zionist position. It is not anti-Semitic to support BDS. It is not anti-Semitic to advocate a one-state solution. You may agree or disagree with one or other or all of those positions, but it is not anti-Semitic to advance it, and the freedom to express those views, to express those positions, to campaign for Palestine, to mount protests in solidarity, etc., has to be rigorously defended. It's quite important not to narrow the argument down to whether or not you hold an anti-Zionist position or you hold a particular view on Israel and Palestine. So I'll give you an example. University College London, the administration adopted the IHRA definition without consultation. The academic board then met to discuss the adoption of the IHRA by their administration. They didn't just meet in a vacuum. There was a long campaign by academics who were determined to fight back against the adoption of the IHRA to win the argument amongst the broader academic body. The vote at the board was absolutely overwhelming against the adoption of the IHRA. Now, that vote was not won amongst academics who are anti-Zionists or who have particularly had any activism around Palestine. These were medics. You know, I'm sorry, but UCL is a kind of regarded as one of the world's most privileged institutions and overwhelmingly a medical institution. But because of the way the argument was conducted, it resonated amongst a very wide layer. And everywhere where that strategy has been adopted, we've won it. That sounds great. The only trouble is, out of a couple of hundred institutions, we're only talking about eight institutions where either the IHRA, they've stopped the adoption of the IHRA, or they've rejected it after its adoption, or they've adopted what's called the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism alongside it. Now, I think the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism, I won't go through this, but it's very important as a tool for the movement in this context of winning the argument, because it is initiated and signed by over 200 now international Jewish scholars who include anti-Zionists, non-Zionists, and crucially Zionists, and very importantly, Israeli scholars. Now, in a sense, it sums up that principle because it rejects the conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, with BDS, with one-state solution, with calling Israel a settler colonial state. Now, its signatories by no means necessarily agree with those positions. But the important thing is they reject the conflation with anti-Semitism. Therefore, to cite the Jerusalem Declaration, given its authority, it's not a statement signed by the usual suspects of the left, so-called, and like ourselves. Because of its authority and because of the way it's framed, it's an important tool in this battle. I think you can expect, I'd be very surprised if this isn't the case, it's the case everywhere else, that the other side, nonetheless, will press home their, as far as they can, the attacks over free expression in Israel. You've seen in Britain the sacking of an academic in Bristol University, Professor David Miller. We've seen recently, this is referred to in the letter by Australian-Palestinian students I referred to earlier, the University of Glasgow demanding that a very reputable academic, Somdeep Sen, whose book, Decolonizing Palestine, was peer-reviewed, et cetera, demanding to see his presentation beforehand in order to determine whether or not it infringed the IHRA, anti-terror legislation, etc. I mean, Somdeep Sen quite rightly said, refused to meet those conditions and withdrew from speaking. But these kinds of attacks are going to continue. So when I say the movement on two fronts, that is one front. The other front, though, and this is crucially important, is to raise Palestine solidarity in every part of the public space that we can reach, you know, not least on the universities. And in a sense, these two things go together. By building a broad opposition to the IHRA and a broad opposition to the attacks on free expression and free speech, as the left, we can engage with a wider audience than might otherwise be the case to then argue about the issues around Palestinian freedom, Israel and Zionism. So you don't make that a condition, but actually there's no contradiction between the two. And I think there's a number of concrete strategies that we are adopting in Britain that I think will be useful to just quickly run through, David, for Australian comrades and the left and pro-Palestinian movement in Australia. We have a network in Britain which has been central to the opposition to the IHRA on the campuses called BRICUP, which is, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it is the network of academics across British universities who campaign for solidarity and freedom of expression over the question of Palestine. But I'd like to just sort of run through some brief bullet points, which give an indication, really. Petitions. Now, this isn't just about, you know, whether a petition is effective in terms of an outcome, but petitions are important to use within the trade unions, amongst academics, student unions, student societies, and so forth on the campuses, because they engage a wide base and a wide audience. In doing so, you can engage with a wide audience and a wide base and use a petition to muster support for opposition to the IHRA. The use of there's a whole range of legal opinions, the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, for example, citing the condemnation by the main author of the IHRA, Kenneth Stern, against the misuse of the IHRA to suppress freedom of expression and so on, to fight for resolutions through national unions, you know, particularly those in academic unions. When university administrations attempt to adopt the IHRA, to fight for a process of consultation as part of the campaign against the IHRA. Student petitions demanding freedom of debate and discussion on Palestine, on international law and on the nature of the Israeli state, for example. And then, you know, meetings with online speakers to engage as wide an audience as possible. I think, you know, those kinds of strategies are something that I think the left can learn from the successes that, which are certainly not sufficient in number, but the successes that we have had in Britain.